Blog Talk Radio.
Live from New York, you're listening to New York Baseball Digest with Mike Silva.
Another cold January, or the last day of January here on the 31st. Of course, you could be part of the show 24/7, 365 at my radio show blog, nybaseballdigest.com. Just got back from the Bloomberg event a couple of hours ago. It's been a crazy week. Hope everybody's doing well here. Crazy schedule through the Super Bowl. I was away on business this week, so we couldn't do the Wednesday show. We're here, of course, on Sunday. We'll be back on a Wednesday schedule this Wednesday, and then next Sunday we'll be taking off for the Super Bowl. And then really after that, I mean, there's no point in having hot stove because pitchers and catchers are reporting shortly thereafter, and we'll be starting our grapefruit roundups and what have you. And I, for one, this is some of the worst time to talk baseball because you have the Super Bowl. Really, you have something to talk about because there's still some hot stove out there. If you think the Mets and the Yankees are going to make a move, and personally, I think other than a few minor league signings, I don't think that either team is going to be doing anything of significance anymore for the rest of the offseason, what's left of it. And it's just a tough time to talk baseball, but I have a pretty fun show, and I hope you find it fun tonight. Another alumni report to kick it off. It'll be this time Moose Skarin, former Yankees first baseman, played on the dynasty teams of the 50s and 60s, and we kind of had a theme of the Yankees with these alumni reports lately, but it's been really fun, and I really enjoy catching up with these guys. So earlier in the month, I had a chance to talk to Moose Skarin. You'll hear that to kick off the show. I'm going to talk about the Bloomberg event, and then Howard at the same time is going to join me, Howard Magdell of SNY.TV. I'll give you some of the take of what I saw today. I'll put up a brief writing. If you've been on the Twitter account, which is NYBD, twitter.com/NYBD, you probably have seen some of the things that I mentioned throughout the about 5 hours that I was over in the city at the Bloomberg offices checking out both the fantasy product as well as the professional one. And geez, they've outdone themselves. They really put great infrastructure and groundwork to make a serious change in both front offices as well as fans' enjoyment of not only the fantasy aspect of baseball, but just being able to crunch numbers and really delve into the players on their team. So I'll chat about that with Howard. We'll talk about what's going on with the Mets or the lack thereof and some of the, I guess, names that are still out there. I think nothing's going to happen, as I said before. And then another NYBD contributor, Frank Russo, it's been a while. I think this might be his first appearance of the new year. He'll come on and talk a little bit about the Johnny Damon situation. I know he's been upset about the Yankees not signing Johnny Damon, and he has some information. Talk about what he's hearing about the Yankees in terms of not so much moves, but possibility of Curtis Granderson actually going to left field. And we'll also talk about Jobe Chamberlain and some of his comments today, which could be construed as positive. Seems like Jobe, at the very least, is talking a good game. And if he could put his head on straight, geez, with the talent he has, that could be a scary Yankees rotation. So Frank will be talking Yankees baseball throughout the back half of the show. But, you know, we want to get right to it. Let me take a quick commercial break. And then when I return, you'll hear my interview with former Yankees first baseman and member of those dynasty teams in the 50s and 60s, Moose Skarin, and you'll be hearing that right after this.
Don't leave your seat. New York Baseball Digest with Mike Silva will be right back.
I don't know about you, but I'm tired of the cheap gimmicks of radio. Do you want to hear a combination of analysis, rumors, and old-school baseball talk? Then you have come to the right place. No other show brings you New York baseball in words, audio, and video like Mike Silva's New York Baseball Digest at nybaseballdigest.com. Here, former Mets and Yankees remember their moments in the big city, authors share their latest work, and even some of the local media break down the latest from Yankee Stadium and Citi Field. Who knows? Sometimes we catch up with the opposition in our Outside the Apple segments. We even developed our own brand of contributors who bring a combination of professionalism, expertise, and most important, passion for the game. Even the local team's farm system and the independent leagues are covered. Whether you're a veteran journalist or upstart blogger, there is a place for you at nybaseballdigest.com. Nowhere else do you get a 24/7, 365 digest of New York baseball like at nybaseballdigest.com. Hope to see you there.
Attention dog lovers, feel the reward, feel the love. Homeless Golden Retrievers need your help. Long Island Golden Retriever Rescue urges you to visit our website at www.ligrr.org. See how you can adopt, foster, or donate to a Golden Retriever that deserves a chance for a loving home. Please visit www.ligrr.org or call us at 516-578-3803. Never miss a golden opportunity.
Now, back to New York Baseball Digest with Mike Silva.
All right, I am joined by former Yankees first baseman Bill Mouskouron. He's going to be the latest Yankees alumni to join the show. Glad to have you on, Moose. How you doing?
I'm doing fine. I'm hanging in there.
I know. We've been...
79 years old, December 18th.
Wow. Wow.
Been a long time.
I know. We've caught up with some of your former teammates. Jim Coates was just on the show. The late Johnny Blanchard was on last summer. And now we're catching up with you. And, you know, I was seeing your nickname Moose, and I figured, you know, I'm a young guy. I didn't get a chance to see you play, that it was because you were a prolific home run hitter. But apparently it's because of a haircut, huh?
No, Grandpa, my grandfather shaved off all my hair when I was about 8 years old. I was completely bald. And when I got outside, all the older guys started calling me Mussolini. At that time, he was the dictator of Italy, and as years went on through grammar school, high school, and college, everybody called me Moose, and that my first name is William Joseph.
Wow. And you went to Purdue University on, I saw, a football scholarship.
Yes,
but you wound up playing baseball. What happened? You were supposed to play football there, huh?
Well, let me tell you what happened. I never played baseball in high school. I went to a Catholic high school here in Chicago called Weber High School. They only had football and basketball. And I had a chance to go to Notre Dame, and Frank Leahy was the coach, and he says, Moose, if you come to Notre Dame, you're only going to play football. And I says, Coach, I got talent in other sports. So he said, well, you're not coming to Notre Dame. So I went to the Mardi Gras and said my prayers and all that. And Hank Stram and my line coach on the football team in high school went to Purdue University. I went to visit Purdue, and I got signed up by Purdue on a football scholarship, and Hank Stram was my freshman football coach and baseball coach. And when I won the Big Ten batting championship, I hit 500, and all the scouts started coming around, and the Yankees offered me the best deal, and I signed up with them many, many years ago. I signed with them in 1950. And they sent me to Puerto Rico to play winter ball. And who was my manager? It was Roger Hornsby. And I never got his autograph. I should kick myself in the fanny.
Do you ever think, well, would you have been a pro football player? Or I mean, obviously you made the right decision, but did you ever think about whether or not if you had pursued the football?
Well, the thing is, Mike, Cleveland Browns drafted me, Paul Brown, when I was a sophomore in high school. I quit school after my sophomore year at Purdue. And that's when the Yankees offered me a contract, and I quit. I don't know. I was a left. I do everything right-handed except I kicked the football left-footed. I punted for Purdue University. I kicked off, and I kicked field goals for them. So I don't know. The way these guys get banged up, I'm glad I went into baseball because I spent 17 wonderful years.
Yeah, and I was I saw a story, and you could probably tell this better than I, but very early on in your career, there was an old-timers game at Yankee Stadium, and you had a chance to run into Wally Pipp in the clubhouse, and told you, don't take a day off. Look what happened to me. And, of course, you know.
He told me it was an old-timers game, and he called me. He says, Moose, excuse me. He says, Moose, come here, I want to talk to you. And I said, yes, sir. And he says, you know, he says, don't ever get a headache. And I says, why, you know? And he said, well, I took a day off. I went to Miller Huggins, asked for a day off, and Luke Garrett took my place, and he said, I never played again. So from that day on, when my name was in the lineup, no matter what, I played.
Yes.
I had good guys to follow me. I had Joe Pepitone, was a heck of a ball player. I had a guy named Frank Ligia who gave the Yankees gave him an $80,000 bonus. And then a guy by the name of Marv Thornberry who gave him $100,000. So I had a play. You know, they had investments in these guys. And Joe Pepitone was a hell of a player.
Sure. And when you go back now today, you know, knowing that you got advice from a former ball player, do you ever have a chance to return the favor, whether it be at a Yankees Old Timers Day or, you know, you work for the White Sox, of course, in community relations?
I've been with them now 11 years. I'm going to sign my contract. I have a yearly contract with them. I've got a good job with them. I'm in community relations, and I call bingo for senior citizens at the ballpark when they have a day game, and I visit suites. I got a good job, Mike. They've been very good to me. And Mr. Reinsdorf, he's from Brooklyn, New York. He owns the team, and he's been great. And the people I work for are great. So I have no complaints. I'm 79 years old. Where the hell am I going, you know?
Sure. Do you ever have a chance to pass along advice to a current ball player, just like you were giving advice?
You know, there was a ball player. There was a guy that played with the Minnesota Twins. He played center field. And he got traded. I guess now he got traded to the to somebody. I can't think of it. Gomez.
Oh, Carlos. Gomez. He's Gomez. With the Mets. Yes.
Hell of a player, you know. But I said, I got him on the side. You showboat too much. You don't have to do that. He's too good a player to be showboating out there. But that's the way it is today, you know. I don't know. I just get so perturbed when I see these guys playing, these athletes today, and they score a touchdown, and they make a tackle, and they pound their chest and all this stuff. You're getting paid to do this.
Sure.
I don't have to watch you on television pounding your stomach that you made a tackle.
If you had done something like that, maybe point to the sky.
Are you kidding me? Oh, I remember Mickey Mantle give me heck one time. I don't know what the heck I did, but it's like when I first joined the Yankees, Hank Bauer and Gene Woodling, great Yankee outfielders, they says, Moose, don't monkey around with my money. I'm used to winning here. And you better abide by the rules, and you better not break curfew. And that was it. I was a young kid, 22 years old. I was scared. But today, they're making so much money, they give a darn what they do.
Yeah, and you know, I look at your numbers, and you didn't walk a lot.
I swung the bat.
You got on base. That's the key. You know, there's guys today that swing a lot, don't walk, but you guess you knew what pitch to hit. Is that the right way to say it?
That's the way to hit. I swung at anything. I look for certain pitches, and if I knew the guy's a fastball pitcher, I'm going to look for fastballs all the time, you know. If I knew he was a breaking ball pitcher, I'd look for breaking balls. Bob Turley, one of the greatest, he could call pitches from the opposition, and I'd be at the plate, and I'd say, just say, come on, Moose. That means a breaking ball. And I'd look for the breaking ball, and I hit the damn thing.
Wow.
That's the way it was in the old days. I mean, Bob Grimm used to call a lot of pitches. Not Bob Grimm, but Bob Turley called a lot of pitches for Mickey Mantle, too.
Yeah. So you guys were stealing signs, or?
Yes, we were. Sure we were. Why
all
couldn't
time.
We?
Sure. Yeah.
There's pitchers, I'd like to steal the signs all the time.
And you know, you had three really early on in your career great World Series moments. You had the Grand Slam in 56. That put that series away. Now, I know you made the last out in the 57 series, but then in 58, you hit the game-winning another Grand Slam right off of
the day before I drove in the winning run. I can't complain. I played in the most World Series games at first base, Mike. I played in 39 games. I'm one RBI behind Joe DiMaggio for World Series play. Now, they shouldn't count the playoffs in the World Series. Imagine how many home runs Mickey Mantle would have had if they counted playoffs when we played.
Yeah, it would have been a different. I mean, you were in seven World Series with the Yankees. I mean, you were there for the
World
whole dynasty.
Series, you know, and we won five. I was with the Dodgers, which they didn't treat me too good. And I sold my World Series ring. I sold my uniform. I didn't want that stuff. I was a Yankee. I spent 3 years in the minors with them, 9 years in the majors. We won 10 pennants out of 12 years. So I can't complain.
Wow. So, you know, that was what I was going to ask you. So you had it was a tough year with the Dodgers in 63.
Well,
you know,
I was having a bad year. And Ron Fairley, who was a great player, was having a heck of a year. I think he finished up hitting like 345, But when the World Series started, I played against Whitey Ford, got a couple hits. The next day, Aldani's pitching. I hit a home run. I play against my Yankees. We beat them four in a row. I hit 385 against them. And Koufax, Drysdale, Johnny Padres, and Ron Paranowski, we beat them four in a row.
Yeah. Was that sweet for you? I know the why did the Yankees trade you? Was it a matter of...
I think, well, because they thought Pepitone was the guy who didn't take my job. They got Stan Williams for me. But listen, the Yankee organization was always great to me. And I look forward to going to Old Timers Day and seeing my... I talked to Yogi Berra a couple of days ago. He called me up, wished me a Merry Christmas and everything. So I have a nice report. The Yankees were always good to me. What can I say?
That's true. Now, in the 7 World Series of the Yankees, you played some tough teams. It was, of course, I know you lost to Brooklyn and Milwaukee and Pittsburgh. You beat San Francisco. And then, you know, in 61, you beat Cincinnati. Was there one team when you guys went into that World Series, you were like, this is going to be a tough one. Does one series stand out for you?
San Francisco Giants with Mays and McCovey. That's the ones we were worried about. And it's funny, Tony Kubek hitting a double play, and I scored the winning run. We won 1-0.
Wow. And, you know, that ninth inning, because the rain that slowed the double down there, they would have tied the game.
It rained, and we went on a road trip. We had to buy clothes out there because it was
cold.
We were postponed a couple of games.
Yeah, and it was, I'm sure, playing in Candlestick very early on. That was a tough ballpark in October. Pretty cold, huh?
Yes, it was.
Yeah.
But it turned out all right. We beat him. That's all that counts.
And you also, you know, I was curious if there was an all-star game that stood out for you. You were in 6 of them. Maybe I thought 1960 where the Yankees. Yeah, 8 of them. Sorry.
Because we played 2 in 1 year, so you got to count 8.
Sure. Was there one that stood out to you, maybe the one at Yankee Stadium in 1960 or one that...
I don't remember. The only ones I remember was I told Enos Slaughter and Stan Musial, what a ballpark to hit in Sportsman, that right field. I hit the screener a couple times down there in St. Louis.
Wow. Look at
that. I don't remember the All-Star game that well.
No.
I remember the World Series.
Now they play because... You know, you have to have home field. You guys were playing to win back then, too, with the All-Star Game. Or was it kind of like an exhibition?
Well, I'll tell you what, we used to beat the heck out of the National League All-Stars. And what happened, there was a Warren Giles had a meeting, and he tore those guys apart. And they said, and Warren said, you better start playing as winners and representing the National League. Then they gave us a hard time.
Interesting.
And they start beating us. That's the truth. That happened.
And you know, in 61, you hit pretty well 2 in the World Series. Now, you guys lost Mantle before that series started. Did that kind of, you know, was a sign to you, hey, I got to step up here. I got to make up for some of the lost production?
Well, then they put Roger Maris in center field and then put Blanchard in right field. Then Hector Lopez played left field, you know. Mickey tried to play, but he couldn't play because the blood was coming out of his uniform. You know, I'll tell you, to me, he was a complete player. He's the greatest ball player that I played with or against in my career. Maris, Mantle, and Moose, we hit 143 home runs, which is still a record today as a threesome. At three catchers that hit 20 or more home runs, Yogi Berra, Elson Howard, and Johnny Blanchard.
And I think you might have helped Maris, too. You batted behind him in 61. I mean, hey, listen, it's got to help having a great hitter behind him. You got to see a few more fastballs, huh?
I guess so. I don't know. I just swung, Mike. I attacked. I swung the bat. I didn't go for no walks.
And you mentioned Mantle, the greatest player ever. You were actually a pallbearer at his funeral. You were very close to him.
Yes, me and I met him when I was 19 years old. Mickey was 18 years old. We roomed together at the Concourse Plaza Hotel. We worked out with the Yankees, and then he went to Triple A, and I went Class B ball, and we were very close friends for many years.
And it was
I miss him very much, and Roger Maris too.
Yeah, it was tough early on for Mickey too, right? Coming, you know, we got up, and he struggled a little bit at the beginning.
Yes, he did, but his father told him, "It's either you play or go home."
Yeah, it was probably the best advice. Now, the other thing I noticed in '64 when you were with Chicago. You know, you guys almost nipped the Yankees.
One game.
9 in a row to end the season, and if the Yankees had lost one more, you would have came back from 4 out with 10 to play. So that was interesting.
We beat them 4 in a row, and Phil Lenz got on the bus and started playing harmonica. And Yogi and him got into a little battle. That's what motivated the Yankees. The Yankees won 11 in a row. We won 9 in a row, lost the pennant by one game.
So Phil Lynch actually turned things around for the Yankees that year.
Yes, he did. Good old harmonica.
And I noticed you do the Heroes in Pinstripes, the fantasy camp. You still involved in getting out there on the field?
Yes, sir. We had our camp in Glendale, Arizona. We had a great bunch of former Yankees there, and we had about 70 campers there, and now I work for the White Sox, so I'm going to Glendale, Arizona next Sunday for a week to be with the White Sox fantasy camp. Bill Melton runs it, and there's going to be a lot of guys that are going to be there that I haven't seen in many years. Tom Pachark's going to be there, and Jim Fregosi. So we'll have a good time.
Yeah. Well, here's one last question before I let you go. This might be a tough one. Out of all the Yankee teams you played on that won the championship, was 61 the best? Do you think maybe one of the 50s teams was better?
I never played in the 50s. Well, I did play in the 50s. The greatest team I played with was the 61 Yankees.
Now listen, Moose, a pleasure talking to you. Thank you so much for taking some time with us. I really appreciate it. Good luck. Have fun at the fantasy
camp. No problem.
Camp.
Same to you, Mike.
All right. Take care. That's Moose Skowron. I had a chance to catch up with him earlier in the month. Wanted to play that earlier, but with the schedule and kind of some days we had to take off, it got pushed back a little bit. But Jim Coates last week, Moose Skowron this week, chance to kind of go back and remember those late 50s, early 60s Yankees, and hope to catch up with more of those guys, and we'll try to get some Mets alumni in the near future. We'll continue to work on that. But anyway, let's move right along, and we could fast forward a few years from 1961 and welcome in our good friend from SNY.TV, Howard Megdell. Howard, how are you? What's going on?
I'm sitting here listening to that terrific interview and thinking, who is the Mets equivalent in history of Moose Skowron? And is it John Milner? I wonder who it would be.
That's interesting. I didn't think of that. I mean, John Milner's a good one. Power. Yeah, you know, when you think about it, first base, John Milner's a pretty good comparable on there.
I'm thinking he would have been my pick. But
yeah, unless you want to put Rusty Staub at first. But
possible, but Staub's more of an outfielder. I think Milner's the guy, but I'm not sure what that says about the Mets, because certainly John Milner, nice enough player, but no Moose Skowron in his own right. That's for
no.
Sure.
Here's a funny email I got during the Skowron segment from Ray Martell. I don't know if you know Ray Martell.
Sure, of course.
Yeah, well, he connects on Facebook, and he says to me, you know, nice spot with Skowron. Funny story, I had to dump him when we had him on the Fan. He said BS, really funny. He said the actual word. So,
right.
You know, Moose, I guess, didn't know the seven deadly words that the FCC doesn't like. But
I know Ray Martell going back to the website d3hoops.com, where we had many a fine discussion about the Bard basketball team.
Really? Is he from Bard?
No, he is not. But I was, and bringing a fair amount of attention to the Bard college program back when I was in college. But that was a long time ago.
Is D3 done? Is that website no longer?
Oh no, still very much in progress, and I would highly recommend it to anyone. If you have any interest in Division III hoops, you go over to d3hoops.com. Pat Coleman runs that. Just an absolutely terrific site.
Is Bard improved? I know that they had some tough times when you were there.
Well, they have a new coach named Adam Turner, who is actually the all-time leading scorer for the team, and it's having a little bit of a tough first year, trying to adjust, bringing in some players, and 1-17 coming into the game today against Yeshiva. But as it turns out, the team, yes, it has some work to do, but really has a chance to be very good.
Yeah, well, Howard, you always find a positive spin, no matter if it's Bard basketball or the New York Mets, huh?
Well, Mike, there's nowhere to go but up.
That's true. Well, I'll start off before we talk about before we talk about the Mets. I want to kind of talk about this Bloomberg event I went to today, and I don't know if you had a chance to read. And Maury was talking about this during the winter meetings, but well, what do you know about this software? I'm just curious what you've heard so far.
You know, very little. So I'm really curious about what your take was on it. It's very interesting to me to see Bloomberg getting involved on this side of the baseball business. So I'm curious to see it. And as far as I'm concerned, any added competition in any of these areas when it comes to baseball statistical innovation is an inherent good thing. So I'm fully in favor of it, but I really don't know what their angle is. What did you find out?
Well, here's the thing. First, Dan Dockeroff, who used to be deputy mayor to Mike Bloomberg,
sure,
of course, he's running the company now, and he kind of introduced it. And the quote he gave, and it was kind of a quote, I started to hear it, and I'm like, oh, here we go. And it was like, well, players are securities and teams are the portfolio. That's kind of the concept here. And it really, it's two guys that work for the company, work for Bloomberg. They're fantasy sports fans, you know, baseball fanatics. Mm-hmm. And they basically went to management. And this is pretty, you know, look, I work for big companies. So what these kids did, they basically went to management, presented this concept where, you know, hey, why don't you just take these charts and graphs that we use mm-hmm. to measure securities and their performance and put baseball players and kind of use it to help fans with their fantasy leagues because, mm-hmm. you know, there's not enough information out there. And the Bloomberg senior management said, great, do it on your time. So these
right.
kids spent on their own time in addition to their job. I shouldn't say kids. They're young men like you and I.
Mm-hmm.
And they basically put to, you know, the genesis of the product. They put this together. They've you know, obviously done a lot of work and research, and then they've also expanded it to the professional side, getting input from people like Kevin Towers, scouts, and statistical analysts. And you really have two parts to it. You have the fantasy side, which, Howard, basically renders any fantasy magazine useless. You'll never need to spend. I mean, between the draft kit, which is about $19, and then
right.
the in-season update, for about $31 for both together, you could get real-time updates. And pretty much anything that you would want to grab from either ESPN, FanGraphs, Baseball Reference, and then some, in actually chart format, similar to the charts you would see when you'd be looking up you know, the P.E. ratio of a stock.
Sure.
You know, things like that. That's the fantasy side. To bring it over to the pro side, what I think is really important, and I wanted to put this out there because I know what some fans are going to say, why would a pro team want to use this? Well, this isn't just statistics. This is the ability for them to input scouting data, their own scouting data, their own proprietary information, getting college information in there. You know, right now, this is what's amazing, and I guess you and I always seem to get shocked at how behind maybe baseball is, but
mm-hmm.
there are actually people putting a lot of information throughout the season together manually that now can be done literally, you know, if Joe Girardi wants, this program could print out a comprehensive chart of, you know, Manny Ramirez or David Ortiz, and you'll know what his hot zones are, where he's going to hit the ball on the field, the percentage of time he hits it on the field. I mean, it could really and Bloomberg was very clear. They're not trying to revolutionize the game. They're trying
mm-hmm.
to add a tool. And I'll tell you what, you know, it's not much different than what you see on Fox with all those zones. And then when you add the FX data, the pitch FX, and then the hit FX later on, Howard, you're going to get some serious numbers to work with.
And they should. And, you know, when you're talking about things like, all right, Manny Ramirez is coming up, so here's his hot zone. It's
right.
fairly astounding that this information has existed for quite a while. It's available to you. It's available to me on any number of websites. But somehow that a pitching coach, when he goes out to talk to the pitcher before a big at-bat, is not – A, privy to that direct information, or B, bringing that information to bear on those conversations. And so it's really a way to, like we were talking about, bringing baseball into the 21st century in a very significant way.
Yeah, I mean, the fantasy game is really where this all starts. That's the big, big product. You know, obviously this is going to be expensive for teams, and they did say, now there's two things they were very coy about. One, the changes that have been made since the winter meetings, and two, for the fantasy game, they have their own ranking system called B-Rank.
Mm-hmm.
And they didn't really want to obviously give the engine behind that, and a lot of people were grilling them on that. And I think that's what's going to be interesting for the fan debate with the fantasy game, because these rankings always look at Pacoda, the baseball prospectus rankings
sure.
earlier this
mm-hmm.
week. You look at all the talk about that. You know, these things kind of will bring to the forefront. And I'll tell you what, right now, and I spoke to some of the guys, you know, in between breaks, they're not planning on having their own fantasy game. Basically, you could go into this software, put what league, like, you know, you would say Yahoo League, Rotisserie, and they'll do rankings for you.
Right.
So they're not looking
right.
to compete with all these leagues. They're looking to be a tool for these leagues. And then I'll say one last thing on the pro side, the team side. This, you'll appreciate this quote. There were about five or six teams that loved the product but felt overwhelmed by the amount of information that they didn't think they would use it because they wouldn't know how to manage the information coming
in. And now think about that for a minute. That statement, it's funny. It doesn't surprise me. But these are multi-million-dollar corporations. Say whatever else you will about baseball teams. They are multi-million-dollar corporations, and they don't have necessarily the people at their disposal to interpret the most up-to-date data on how to be successful. So what do they choose to dispose of? The people who aren't able to deal with the data or the data itself, they dispose of the data. How backward thinking is that?
Yeah, that's true. Now, I agree. It will be overwhelming when you go, even for a fantasy player. Like, I was, and Steve Keane from the Crane Pool Society was there, and I turned to him. I said, geez, you really need to know what you're looking for here because you could analyze just about anything with these charts. But I think where it's a win for these teams is that they can put their own information. I mean, there are many teams that have their own proprietary analysis on defense, base running. Eventually sabermetrics will be. That was something that right now wasn't part of the standard statistical analysis, but they're going to add that. Jonah Kerry of the Times is actually going to work with them and write for them and be kind of a liaison there. So, that stuff's going to make its way in, war, UZR.
Let me make one other point, which is that if Jonah Kerry is involved, it becomes an inherently better project.
Yeah, and he was there, definitely. I'll tell you what, Howard, they're serious. Now, I'm not going to say they're going to put out other companies out of business, but if they continue to grow, and I think the biggest thing I took from them, they're very open to feedback. They incorporated not just independent media like me and mainstream like Kerry, but there were a number of blogs there, not necessarily blogs that have tremendous traffic, but they have blogs. They wanted to get this out there to get feedback from fans. And I'm telling you, they're going to get feedback from teams. I mean, the fact that they have a guy like Kevin Towers, on this thing, kind of giving them, what he thinks, a former GM working for the Yankees, tells you how serious they are. When you see this...
I don't mean to interrupt you, but just to hear Jonah described as mainstream media is so fantastic because it really points to just how far sabermetric ideas have come, inside the past decade. Jonah was a writer of Baseball Prospectus when I first encountered him via email, just going back and forth actually about the Montreal Expos. Mm-hmm. And to hear Jonah as a mainstream baseball writer, which you're right, he absolutely is just an absolutely fantastic thing. I am just going to point out one other thing. Jonah is working on a book right now about the Tampa Bay Rays that when it comes out, everyone in our audience ought to read. But anyway,
he did mention
Jonah,
that.
That's all my Jonah plug-in for now.
No, and I didn't know he was a financial writer. He still is actually a financial writer.
He is. A potent combination for sure.
And I'll give you another funny thing. I ran into Sam Page of Amazing Avenue at the event. And I did say, you saw the face of evil and it is good, I told him. And he laughed. And, we had a good laugh out of the back and forth between NYBD and Amazing Avenue that it's all in good fun. I said, I'm really not a bad guy. I don't know why I'm on, ban over there, but he laughed.
Was a peace treaty signed on the spot?
No. Apparently he doesn't have enough juice over there to sign a peace treaty. He's like, I don't know, if you had to think about politics, he could be a liaison without much juice. You'd have to think of a political figure that, would go overseas, have a conversation, but, not necessarily be able to broker
the deal.
He might
just be saying that. All the people with the true power don't have to say that.
That's true. Well, that's an interesting segue because, the big question this week is who runs the New York Mets? And, Howard, Met fans are listening in the audience, and I know they are. I think that the funny part is one of the examples used to kind of use the professional product of Bloomberg was they brought up Luis Castillo's numbers. So, and Steve Keen said is his contract buyout in there, and everybody laughs and stuff. But, nobody really believed the Mets are using this stuff, although to be fair, Jeff Wilpon did say at the winter meetings that he was very intrigued by the software. New York Mets, SNY did a – and I didn't see the interview live. I saw some of the clips. Burkhart did a great job with Manaea.
He really did.
Really tough, and I hate to dump on Yes and WFAN with Francesco because it's kind of like getting old. But, you know, you don't get that with a lot of networks, especially
their
own
mother team.
Well,
I mentioned this to you at the time of the Jason Bay signing, that Tevin Burkhardt, who is just a fantastic reporter, who does absolutely fantastic things on a regular basis and is the beat reporter for the network that, you know, your team owns, he should have been the one to break the Jason Bay news. And the idea that it was Mike Francesa was very odd.
Yeah. Well, I have my theories on that. But, you know, the whole, you know, Wilpon running the team, you saw the only column in Rosenthal talking about the Mets not setting a budget.
Mm-hmm.
I'm starting to think one of two things. You know, can they possibly be this out of touch? Are they, you know, setting Jerry and Omar up for failure by kind of putting them out there for pasture? Because that's what it seems like. Do they have the wrong people running? I'm just, at this point, very confused about what is going on, because dumping on the Mets is fashionable, it's easy, but I cannot possibly think that Omar Minaya, the guy that was able to bring Carlos Beltran here, bring Pedro Martinez here, in a worst period in team history, coming off a talentless team that lost almost 100 games,
right,
could all of a sudden have fallen from grace where he's this incompetent with no power, and this team, you know, right now is just signing guys like Josh Fogg. I don't even know how to give the audience a qualifier and make them even rationalize. I don't know how to rationalize what's going on right now.
You know, I don't either, and I hear a lot of people complaining about it without any direct knowledge of exactly what the decision-making process is this winter. But I think it's incumbent upon me and upon every reporter out there to start to get those answers. And, it's something where one way or the other, what the Mets are doing isn't working. And so you can, as the Mets, you can take it one of two ways. And you can either say, you know, look, this is our process, and we know what the process is, and we're going to take a look at it and figure out a way to make it different. For all we know, the process has changed significantly this past winter, but what we've seen in terms of results has not changed. And by results, I don't mean just the thing on the field, because ultimately you can't just measure this in a single set of wins and losses. But when you talked about player injuries being dealt with in a timely manner, that wasn't happening with Carlos Beltran. When you were talking about the communication, there was an absolute clear lapse there. Whatever happened, whoever was at fault, and, you know, pretty clearly, when push came to shove, by the end of that week, it was pretty obvious that what was at fault was that the Mets had not communicated this quickly enough, and it wasn't even clear that they should have been communicating what they weren't able to communicate. So that was a big problem, and that's another example of results. And in terms of their ability to sign pitchers, to sign players who they needed to, and more to the point, who they wanted to, there was a gap between the players the Mets wanted to sign and the players that they did sign. And so, indisputably, in terms of results for the organization, it isn't working. And I don't know why there hasn't been that urgency year after year to try and get this right. I don't know why, when Omar Minaya had more autonomy, that there wasn't more of an effort to revert to that, that as soon as there were any setbacks on the field, it seems like the Mets reverted to the thing that they needed to avoid when they brought Minaya in to begin with. I have no answers on this today, but I'm going to make absolutely certain that I find out these answers, because ultimately there needs to be an awareness of who needs to be held accountable, because this has just gone on way too long.
Well, I'll give you, and again, you're right. I don't know if you're going to get answers, because Minaya doesn't say anything. He says mm-hmm. the same thing over and over and over again.
Mm-hmm.
Wilpon is not media friendly, and I would
Absolutely.
Think he's going to try to avoid the media. Here's one thing I'll say, and it's going to sound very Pollyannish, and it's going to reek of trying to be pro-Met, but none of the players they've missed out on this offseason, the pitchers, I've really said, oh, they really needed that guy. Bay was the guy, or Halliday, I felt they needed a bat. I would have been comfortable with – yeah, go ahead, I'm sorry.
Just to say very briefly, for what it's worth, I wasn't even sure they should go get Bay. What I'm talking about isn't did they get exactly the right players? And that's what I mean in terms of it doesn't really matter. Did they do enough to get to 95 wins, you know, or 75? Or God only knows what they'll end up with this year, depending on who stays healthy. The point is not that they absolutely needed Joel Piniero and Benji Molina in order to compete. I didn't want them getting Molina at any price, and I really didn't like the idea of Piniero, a ground ball pitcher, when they weren't addressing Luis Castillo at second base. That said, if they made it a point that they wanted to go get these guys, and because of a lack of communication, because my understanding is that it had everything to do with Joel Piniero not receiving an offer in time and nothing to do with the Mets not wanting Joel Piniero that kept him from getting it, that is a huge problem in terms of results. And if it means that, wow, they didn't get Piniero, he would have been a bad contract anyway, and now John Main turns around and gives him 200 great innings, that's not a good enough reason to say, oh, the system works. That's random chance. And
right.
That's a much bigger problem than having the right pitcher in the right spot for one particular year.
Absolutely. I'll add one thing, and then I want to hear what you got coming up. I do think, and again, this is not, the Mets fans don't want to hear this, that you mentioned health. I think you need to see what you got with Perez and Maine and Pelfrey, and I think it'll be a little bit more crystal clear very early in the season where this team stands, mm-hmm. what they need. And I don't think any of the needs, if the guys stay healthy, and some of those are bigger ifs than others, mm-hmm. if the guys stay healthy, I think the needs that they may have can be filled in season. Is that Pollyannish?
Number one, no, Pollyannish, I wouldn't describe it as such. Number two, I would point out a different reality, because that is something that could happen. By reality, I'm not saying that isn't reality. I'm saying we don't know what reality is going to be. But let me give you a different alternative. If you don't sign Piniero or anyone else, et cetera, you are now able to get a sense of, number one, what you got in Oliver Perez. Number two, what you have in John Main. Number three, what you have in Mike Pelfrey. And if these guys are what you're hoping they will be, then that is significant. If they're all not what you hope they would be, the season is going to go down the drain. But if just some of them are what you hope they will be, they're still not really contenders. And that jumps to the other side of the ledger in terms of hitters, that 2010 can become a training ground for figuring out what you have in 2011. And suddenly 2010 is a golden opportunity to give Josh Tolley a job as the regular catcher, see what he can do for you, give him on-the-job training. If he's going to benefit from a year in AAA, it's not a question of his bat. It's a question of learning how to handle major league pitchers. Nothing's going to allow him to better understand how to handle major league pitchers than handling major league pitchers. So I see that as a net gain. You bring up Ike Davis mid-year, and you get to see what he has and give him some major league experience going into 2011. Hopefully the same for Fernando Martinez, and if he manages to stay healthy, Rhys Havens can come up if you finally bite the bullet and get rid of Luis Castillo and his contract. And frankly, if you can't get rid of his contract, you get rid of him anyway, and you get a sense moving forward of what the Mets have. So 2010 at that point, rather than a question of can you fill the needs in season, I presume you meant with a trade, what you actually have an opportunity to do is see, well, just how many of these needs can we fill with the young players we have coming up, supplementing Wright, Reyes, both remember entering their age 27 seasons, plenty of peak to go. Santana hopefully has plenty left. You know, he's only 30 years old as of right now. And then you head into next offseason with a far richer array of choices and a real chance to fill a couple of needs, fill that final couple of voids, and really compete going into 2011. That is an ideal fantasy for what the Mets would do, and I got to tell you, it's belied by the way they've done business for the last 5 years.
So we're off next week for the Super Bowl. The next time you and I will talk will be our annual Pitchers and Catchers
mm-hmm.
Show. Amazing that it's upon us. What are you going to do? What are you going to do between then and now? Are you going to watch the Pro Bowl? Are you going to watch the Super Bowl? Are you going to catch up on movies? Are you going to try to see if there's any free agents the Mets could sign? Have you got any plans in between now and Pitchers and Catchers?
Let me be clear. I will not be watching the Pro Bowl. Okay. I think that's safe to say. To be perfectly honest, if a good movie is playing Super Bowl Sunday, I'm going to take my wife out to that as well, because, like I say, you can get just about any seat in the house and eat just about anywhere you want for dinner as well. Now, all of that said, this is where my baseball withdrawal becomes particularly acute. There are a few things I need to take care of in terms of Baseball Mogul, which is a fantastic game, Baseball Mogul 2010. I'm going to run a few simulations here moving into the future. Coming up soon, hopefully, is the Diamond Mine projections for 2010. Dan Zimborski over at Baseball Thin Factory posts them for Diamond Mine Baseball, and it is an absolutely fantastic way to get a sense of, day in and day out, how the Mets roster works from a managerial perspective. So I'll be doing that as well. I have the Best of Shea Stadium on DVD. It was something I got knowing that these days would be coming, so I'll be rewatching the Grand Slam single. I'll take a look at Lenny Dykstra's two-run homer that won Game 3 of the 1986 LCS, one of my earliest baseball memories. And beyond that, there's I got actually a toy that has a little bit of catnip in it in the shape of a baseball. And we have sort of some designs on my door that allow it. You know, it's a little. It's not a flat surface, so it's a little bit like playing the wall at Fenway Park. And I've been training the smaller of my two cats to be playing the caroms effectively, and we're getting there. We're getting there. He's not Daniel Murphy out there. That's what.
And I'm sure he did a better job than Lastings Millage did in 2006.
He certainly did. He was no Lastings Millage out there.
All right, well, we'll talk. Enjoy your week off from radio, and I'm sure you and I will talk off air.
And just to plug, howardmeddow.com, check out all the things, MLBtraderumors.com, tomorrow night 6 to 11, SNY piece, early afternoon, perpetualpost.com. I don't think I got to everything.
The busiest man in sports, that's all I could say.
And now to tend to my pregnant wife.
All right, take care, man. Thanks a lot. That's Howard Migdell of SNY.TV and I guess a website near you. Well, he's been on hold for a little bit, but we're going to round out the show with our good friend, his first appearance in the new year, author of the book Bury My Heart at Cooperstown, and we transition to Yankees talk, which is a little bit more positive. It's our good friend Frank Russo. Frank, how are you?
I'm doing okay, man. How are you doing?
I'm all right. I was in a room full of angry bloggers, many who have been angry at NYBD at some point in the last couple of years, and I survived. I'm back in my abode in Long Island. I'm doing the show, and I had a chance to meet some of the fine people at Bloomberg. So I survived the blogger. I actually brought a bulletproof vest with me to the city today.
Well, you should have brought me. I would have helped you out. I would have been you know what I mean?
I know you could have. I know you could have been the bouncer at the event.
Did they threaten you at all, or what?
No, not at all. Actually, some of them are very quite nice, including our good friend Sam Page from Mason Avenue, the place
really?
That I'm banned at. Yeah, so,
wow. Oh, and he didn't threaten you with any like UZR stats or anything?
No, you know what? I think the Bloomberg thing was a little bit more mainstream than even some of the Sabre people would like to admit, and I think it'll be a tool that teams will use because it incorporates scouting and their own types of analysis. So Bloomberg understands that it's not just about war. There's no war on war at Bloomberg. Let's put it that way.
Well, let's put it this way. They want to declare war on us. So, you know, heck with the war. You know what I mean?
Well, Johnny Damon, fans have been, you know, this story won't die. Now, you know, Olney says it's not the Yankees' fault. Damon's, you know, saying, hey, I hope they don't give Derek Jeter a 45% pay cut. What are your thoughts on what transpired with Damon?
I think that basically they played hardball and tried to push the envelope with the Yankees, and, you know, Cashman had his parameters and for whatever reason wasn't going to budge beyond a two-year deal like we reported last July. And you know, it was just a case of one side not wanting to budge to the other and giving to the other. So, you know, I think $14 million for 2 years is very fair, $7 million a year. And, you know, Boris thought that he could play the market, and, you know, he screwed up. And you know, in the long run, I think really there's a lot of, I don't want to call it buyer's remorse or seller's remorse, but there's definitely hurt feelings on both sides, I think, personally. And they both wanted each other back. You know, they wanted to be with each other, you know, and Cashman really started to get a little annoyed at Boris near the end. And, you know, they withdrew that that contract after they signed Nick Johnson, which I still don't understand that signing. And, you know, all in all, I think it was just a really bad move by Boris and Damon. He didn't get really involved with that process till the very last few weeks. And, you know, last weekend he made a call to Brian Cashman, and basically Brian said, hey, sorry, you know what, you want just too much. We're not going to, you know, we'll give you $6 million, that's it, but, you know, nothing more. And, you know, Damon said, okay, and he decided to walk away. But now he's got this this feeling like, you know, where am I going to go? I mean, does he really want to play for Cincinnati, or does he really want to play for Oakland, you know, despite what Pakoda says? And, you know, I don't think Oakland's going to be a very good team this year. And, you know, he doesn't have a lot of options. And he wanted to stay in New York. It was the perfect place. He screwed up, you know.
Yeah, really no, did. I mean, it is for sure now. The you know, a lot of the fans, they look at UZR, they look at the defensive metrics, and they want Curtis Granderson in left and Gardner in center, and it sounds like the Yankees are thinking that way too.
Yeah, I got a little bit of under the table news about that, and it's a very good possibility. You know, my guy down in Tampa was telling me, you know, don't be surprised if that happens, but you know what? You don't know, because who knows? I mean, there's no guarantee that Gardner's going to make the opening day roster. I mean, really, what if he gets injured, or what if he spits the bit and he doesn't do well in spring training? I'm not saying that that's going to happen, but, you know, you never know. I mean, if he doesn't do well in spring training, they may decide to put Curtis Granderson in center and maybe put somebody like Randy Winn in left field, or Gardner in left field even. I mean, you don't know. But I think that that's what they're leaning toward. But, you know, the Yankees don't really care about UZR, okay? They really don't. I mean, that's not what they're about. They're not about statistical metrics. They just believe that Gardner's a faster player and can get to the ball better than Curtis Granderson. That's all. It's not about a defensive metric per se, okay? They don't utilize that. I already checked in with that. They do not utilize UZR when evaluating their outfielders. So let's just set the record straight for that, okay?
It was interesting because Joel Sherman quoted, well, he said a lot of teams like to look at the UZR over 150. And listen, Frank, I can't describe what that 150, all that deal means, you know. But
Some do.
Some do. And I mean, yeah, and that's true. But you know what? I don't think you necessarily need – and again, you know, the whole Kurt Granderson struggles in center – I don't even think you need the stat to know that Gardner is a really good center fielder. I don't think you need the stat to even know that. That's
Granderson's got a better arm. Not much better, but he's got a better arm. You know, but let's look at it like this, Mike. Everybody keeps talking about how great Gardner's going to be next year. All the advanced metricians are talking about how this guy is projected to do this and projected to be this way and that. You don't know how he is going to react to his second full season in the major leagues. He really didn't have a full season last year because he did get injured and he was utilized as a part-time player in the second half of the season. This is really going to be his first real full-time year as a major league player. And you know what? Sometimes he looks a little overmatched, especially with the, you know, when it comes to going up against the bigger power pitchers, you know, like a Verlander or a Josh Beckett. He even looked, you know, actually quite overmatched against some of the lesser pitchers, like, let's say, Jared Weaver. You know,
I'm a little
like
worried
that.
About the offense, because if he doesn't – if he struggles and, you know, look, pitchers are going to pitch to him. He's not an imposing offensive presence. He's pesky if he gets on base. But if he struggles and, you know, if Swisher and Cano kind of regress slightly from their great years last year, look, the Yankees will score runs. This is not the lineup that you had a year ago, though. You know,
you're right. But, you know what? I think that you really can't say that Swisher had a great year. That was an average year for Swish. Swish usually gets between 25 and 30 homers. That's what he averages. So Cano, though, I'm a little worried about. And I was told that they are going to keep an eye on Cano because apparently he was not really happy that Melky was traded. So they're a little worried, the Yankees, that he might start to pout a little bit and, you know, maybe digress a little bit. So they're going to have to keep on him. And he is somebody I worry about. You never know with Cano. That rhymed, actually. I like that. You never know with
Cano. Yeah, and you know what the thing is, and they were actually, that's a nice little, your Yeah, I like that. You're rhyming.
We'll
actually,
have to sell that on NY Baseball Digest website.
And the thing is, see, this is what, and I got a little grief for saying this. I said, well, Cano had a career year last year. And, well, people point out 2007 and 2006, but last year, you know, he had, you know, even, well, he had a very good 2006, but this was a career year. Everything on both sides of the ball went well. He was above his average. So if you get somewhere between 06 and 09, fine, but, you know, that's still a slight regression down. And then you're just looking at Posada. And, people get angry when I say, well, there's only been one catcher in the history of the game that has performed at the level of Posada and performed at that level after age 38, and that's Carlton Fisk. Even Piazza dropped off. So, you know, there are concerns. That doesn't mean that they're all going to collapse and get hurt, but I think it's legitimate for me to wonder, even with the improved pitching, if they're going to hit enough. Now, the Red Sox and the Rays don't exactly have a murderer's row over there either, so maybe it doesn't matter.
Well, the Red Sox fans believe that their team is actually better from top to bottom than the Yankees.
Well, they're going to believe anything that Team Epstein puts out there.
Or Team Gammons, actually, I think.
Team Gammons. Yeah, Gammons. He can't let go of the whole Jason Bay. I actually tried to, when I was in Boston this week, I tried to search for Jason Bay's bum knee, and I found it near a batch of sour grapes. But, you know, that's for another story.
That's beautiful. That was,
that was good.
Did you serve it to anybody with maybe a little Boston cream pie or something?
No, you know, I talked to a Red Sox fan, and they admitted they thought that it was a little over the top with the way that the media has been jumping
on
the
That's how it always has been. It always has been. You very rarely hear of that coming out of New York.
Damon and Pedro stunk when they left. I mean, look, they were right about Pedro. They were wrong about Damon.
You're hearing fans now talk about Damon saying, oh, we don't want him. He's got a baloney arm. He was never really that good, and you know how it is. People like to go after the lover after they've been jilted. But you know what? Look, I wanted Damon back, and look, they've lost a lot of power. They lost the 13 homers from Melky. You can live with that, I guess. But you know, still, they lost the home runs from Matsui. And from Damon, now that's over 50 home runs, okay?
Key really comes down to Granderson. If Granderson could reach that 40 home run plateau in the state with the stadium helping him a little bit because he's a lot lefty.
Well, think about it, though, Michael. Think about it. I mean, first of all, you don't know. He might regress. He might continue to play better. I mean, I don't know. I mean, it's all up in the air right now the way I look at it. I think he's going to have an okay year, Granderson. But the way I look at it is this, you know, a total of 13 homers, that's what it comes out to. When you match up Randy Winn and Nick Johnson, okay, together with and Brett Gardner, those three guys, 13 home runs, that's what you get out of those three guys. That's not very good, okay? Now, and you're replacing them with, you know, you're replacing a Matsui and Damon with those three people, and, you know, come on. I'm sorry, it just doesn't add up. I think they want to try to manufacture runs more. If you want to look at Matsui, it's a wash with that. I mean, Johnson's not going to hit for power, we know that, but he's going to get on base, hopefully, if he stays healthy, you know. As bad as, you know, Matsui has been physically the past couple of years, he still has never been the same injury risk that Johnson has been. And that's something that always worries me. Johnson's always been out of the lineup with some sort of injury, either a broken hand, you know, he's injured his leg, he's done this, he's done that. It gets kind of frustrating after a while. Now, the thing that I'm worried about more than anything is if something happens with an injury, are the Yankees going to go out and actually do something about it, or are they going to try to do something through the minor league system? And you know what?
They have to go out. They just don't have guys who are ready.
They
have no outfield depth. You know, you got Juan Miranda, God forbid.
He's terrible in the outfield. He's horrible. That's why he's
first base.
Yeah.
You could have him if Teixeira gets hurt. You know, catchers, you have plenty of catchers, but no one that could hit like Posada unless Montero develops. It's a little
he
bit
might
of a
be
concern.
Up Montero actually might be up this year. I have a feeling he might be.
Yep.
You know, if
that'll be a lot. That might be the most ballyhooed prospect to debut since maybe
Greg
Jeffrey.
Well, he better do well, Michael, because if he doesn't, it's going to be one of these deals where, well, you know what, you could have included him in a trade for, and you know what, then the Yankees are going to look bad. There's no reason to believe that he won't do well, but you know what? I've always said this. Prospects are just that, and minor leaguers are just that. You don't know how they're going to do at the major league level until they get to the major leagues. And remember, Fernando Martinez was supposed to be this great all-world, you know, minor leaguer. He was highly touted for the Mets. Now, what did he do last year? He was, do you want to say, middling?
He was hurt. You know, he was hurt. I mean, he had a good month in AAA, and this is a big year for him. I mean,
he has to prove it.
4A. Yeah, absolutely.
When you're a minor leaguer, nothing is a given. When you're a minor leaguer, you have to prove to everybody that you can do it. And that's why I try to tell people all the time about Damon. And nobody seems to want to listen to me here. And I think I've been pretty right, you know, pretty much right all the time here when it comes to the way the Yankees have been doing business. You know what? Letting Damon go is not great because this man is a given. He's basically never been on the disabled list, I think, once in his life, if that. This year was the first time. And you know what? The man is a proven commodity, and you don't know what you're going to get out of Brett Gardner for a full season. You will know what you're going to get if he stays healthy out of Johnny Damon, and he's just a very good player. He's part of the championship puzzle, but now he's gone. Now I think I wouldn't surprise me if the Yankees do try to obtain him somewhere down the line again. You don't know. I mean, I don't know, but I think there's still a lot of bitter feelings with Scott Boras, because you know what? I was told that conversation that Cashman had with Boras, boy, oh boy, I'll tell you, it was a lot worse than people make it out to be.
Yeah.
I heard basically some four-letter words were dropped, and it was not good. They were very agitated at Boras, and you know what? What is Sherman was trying to say, or was it Olney who was trying to say that the Yankees weren't at fault here? That
yes,
it was Boras.
Yeah,
and Boras is saying that it wasn't his fault; it was the Yankees. You know what? That's not true. The Yankees offered them a really nice deal. In this economy, for a 36-year-old outfielder, 2 years of $14 million, it's Boras's fault. And it's Johnny Damon's fault. But you know what? The Yankees could have budged a little bit near the end. They could have given up more. I mean, they found the money for Teixeira last year. But I think it also comes down to a case where that they found the money for Teixeira because he was such a valuable commodity. I mean, here was basically
in prime,
the best positional player in his prime on the market last year. Johnny Damon is not the best player at his position. I mean, he's a 36-year-old outfielder. I think if he was 26 years old or 29 or 30, or maybe even the Johnny Damon of 4 years ago, they would have done something about it and found the money. They weren't going to find that kind of money, what they were looking for originally, which was what? They wanted a four-year, $39 million contract? I mean, that's a lot to be asking, you know, right out of the gate. They had to be out of their minds to be asking that.
Hey, one last thing before we wrap up here. Chamberlain saying some positive things. You know, you talked about prospects before. Coming to spring training 2 weeks early before pitchers and catchers report. You know, has some competition. It's funny now, everybody, you were talking about this last year that Jabba was a little too comfortable in his role. You know, all year we heard the greatness of Jabba and people getting angry anytime we questioned Jabba, how he acted or how he was handled. You know, it was a topic that was off limits. But, you know, now you hear even some bloggers and fans saying, well, you know, he might have been a little too comfortable last year. And he's got now Mitre and Gaudin and Acevedo and Hughes competing with him for that fifth spot. Give us, to wrap up here, your thoughts. You know, you're feeling good about at least what you're hearing from Chamberlain.
Yeah, I think he started working out a couple of weeks ago. And, you know, he's still been, you know, running the gamut of his charities and, you know, celebrating and everything. But he's been keeping himself in pretty decent shape. And he still has to go to the Munson Awards, which I think is coming up this week. So he still has to go to New York for that. But as a whole, though, I think he's going to be okay this year. I mean, he knows that this is a very, very important year for him. And I think that he knows more than anybody that, look, the chains have been broken. He's allowed to get off the leash now this year, and he can pitch wherever basically he is best suited for, whether it's going to be in the starting rotation or the bullpen. I think he still prefers to be a starter, but you know what? If he doesn't make it out of spring training as a starter, he's going to go in the bullpen. I don't think they really want to do that, the Yankees, as I've told you. I think that they want to let Jabba go because he doesn't have the innings limitations anymore. And I think he's ready to unleash himself. But you know what? I've told you this before, and I'll continue to reiterate this. I think that Jabba is better suited as a whole as a bullpen person because for some reason he just has not ever been able to utilize all four of his pitches. And he just seems freer as a setup man. But you know what? They're going to put him in the fifth spot in the rotation. Hopefully he'll do fine. And if he doesn't, if he spits the bit, they're going to use somebody else. You know, so I think he knows that he can't go around screwing around like he did last year. If you remember, Jeter and a few other people, you know, went up to him and said, "Hey, you got to stop messing around here." We even saw it during a game last year, if you remember, where he was really screwing around. And he was walking people and he wasn't concentrating on the mound. And DJ went up to him, walked up to him on the mound in the middle of an inning and said, "Hey, stop screwing around." And after that, his whole entire demeanor changed. So, you know what, I think he needs to take that focus and he needs to go out there and, you know, become a true professional. And that's one of his problems, I think. I think sometimes he acts a little bit too much like baby Jabba instead of a professional.
Yeah.
I know that sounds a little harsh.
No, hey, listen, I'm with you 100% on that. Now, are you going to stay warm? Are you going to watch the Super Bowl? Or are you going to go the route of Howard and completely find other things to immerse yourself in over the next, 7 to 10 days where baseball kind of becomes a drag because you're really waiting for pitchers and catchers?
Well, next week is my wife's birthday, so I'm going to take her out on a...
You better spend some money on her, Frank. She puts up a lot.
Oh, yeah, I already have her present.
A Yankee-centric present that's really more for you.
No, it's actually a Red Sox Nation little logo.
A Mike Cameron bobblehead doll and an Adrian Beltre gold glove.
It's a Red Sox Nation logo in 14-karat gold tin. and also we have a Peter Gammons reversible mirror so she can shave her legs. And
a Carl Crawford unsigned contract, right?
And let me tell you something. Let's not even get into Carl Crawford.
We can do another hour of all that. We'll have to wait till next time.
You know what? Next time I'm on the air, we'll talk about some things because I've got some possible destinations for Carl Crawford, but it won't be the Yankees if he is traded. Right. But let's not even get into that. We don't want to infuriate the troops out there. But no,
yeah.
I'll watch the Super Bowl because I'm a huge Peyton Manning fan. I love Peyton Manning. I love Eli too. So you know, Peyton Manning is my guy, and I'll watch the Super Bowl. And you know, I'll take my wife out to dinner, enjoy myself, and get ready for spring training. And if I'm bored, maybe I'll even watch some of the World Series DVDs. You know, I will not throw a ball of catnip, at my cat because I don't think my cat's ever even smelled catnip before. So, you know, to her, she may throw it back at me. So,
great segment. Had a great time. We'll catch up and have a good night, my man.
All right, man. Same to you, and I'll talk to you in a week or two.
All right. That's Frank Russo, author of the book, Bury My Heart at Cooperstown. Got a little bonus coverage tonight. I decided to give it a little extra 10 minutes. That's the beauty of internet radio. We're not hard, you know, deadlines. I like to keep things an hour, but wanted to give Frank an extra time there to talk about a few issues, and Howard and I wanted to get into the Bloomberg thing and obviously Muscowan earlier in the show. But obviously right now, we are out of time, but you can listen to the replay of this show or any show at nybaseballdigest.com. I'd like to thank Muscowan, Howard Megdell of SNY, and Frank Russo, author of the book Bury My Heart at Cooperstown. Want to thank Blog Talk Radio and 1240 AM WGBB for hosting the show, and remember to tune in for the best features, interviews, opinions, and analysis on New York baseball at nybaseballdigest.com. I'm your host, Mike Silva. Enjoy the rest of your night. We'll be back on Wednesday. Got a fun segment for you, so keep checking out the website and see what's next on Wednesday's edition of NY Baseball Digest Radio. Take care.